Hello, I'm Detlev Schmalhaus. This is number 0566, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0566. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Dr. Joanna Dodd Massey, who is the author of Culture Shock, Surviving Five Generations in One Workplace.
29% of baby boomers over the age of 65, right, which is the traditional retirement age, were still at work or looking for work in 2018. That's a very large percentage. We've not seen anything like that before. And it causes a logjam for younger generations, including Gen X and millennials, and then at some point Gen Z, because they can't move up the corporate ladder because the older workers aren't leaving.
Sam Mack is the author of Muslim Mythbusting. What led her to writing this book?
I have had so many friends come to me and say, someone said something about Islam or Muslims, and I knew it wasn't true, but I didn't know what to say. So I wanted a really easy, quick read book where people would know what to say and want to have some actual understanding, not just what the media is portraying. And the media, you know, it's for selling papers and it's for getting clicks and likes and attention. It's not necessarily for cohesive truth and bettering society. They've never said we're doing this to better society. It's a business.
Chantel, Amy Osman is the editor of Agora Books, a new diverse publishing imprint.
We noticed that there was just a level of sameness to all of the crime fiction that was being put out by Big Five publishers. Crime fiction, which at its core is about justice and society and learning things about different cultures and people and viewpoints. It just wasn't being represented in any way, and we definitely weren't seeing what we wanted to read. So after talking for a while, we came up with Agora Books, which focuses on crime fiction of different social and cultural viewpoints.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0566, is someone near and dear to my heart, Detlev Schmalhaus. He is a technical rep at Proden Enterprises, and he's been my best friend for all of my adult life. As a matter of fact, I was the best man at his wedding twice. Thank you very much, Daddy, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, the world is filled with stories about police officers overstepping their boundaries, but we here at the Stuff File program like to dig a little deeper to find that special, different kind of story. Texas prosecutors said a former school district officer told a woman she could go if she let him smell her feet or handed over her underwear. The Harris County District Attorney's Office said Cy-Fair School District Officer Patrick Quinn, who has since been fired, pulled over a woman at 3 a.m. for an expired sticker and told her that her vehicle smelled of marijuana. Quinn, who prosecutors said should not have even been conducting traffic stops as a school resource officer, claims to have found a marijuana grinder in the woman's car. The woman told authorities Quinn put her in the back seat of his patrol car. She said the officer told her she could go free if she allowed him to smell her feet or if she gave him her underwear. However, Quinn apparently had a change of heart and told the woman to forget about it. The woman, who Quinn allowed to leave the scene, reported the incident the following day. Quinn was charged with two counts of official oppression. Now, why do I get the feeling that as a kid, Patrick Quinn used to go out at Halloween dressed as a cop and Somehow, this is simply residual effects to some sort of past October trauma. I mean, smelling feet and underwear? Where could he have come up with this stuff?
Trick or treat, smell my feet, give me something good to eat. If you don't, I don't care, I'll pull down your underwear.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, Koala, an infamous alcoholic monkey, and if I had a nickel for every time I said that sentence, in Kanpur, India, has been sentenced to live out his days in isolation. The animal once belonged to a local occultist who would give him alcohol. After the owner died, Kalua couldn't get his fix and became aggressive, sinking his teeth into more than 250 people, one of whom died of his wound. The Kanpur Zoo took Koala in, trying to acclimate him to captivity and other monkeys, but zoo workers are throwing in the towel. It has been 3 years since he was brought here, said zoo doctor Mahood Nasir. He will remain in captivity all of his life. Gee, I thought society had gotten past the point of where we just lock up our drunks indefinitely. Have they given up on the idea of AA? I'm sure there are some meetings Kalua could go to, maybe get a sponsor. Then again, it might be difficult for him to go through the 12 steps. Number 8 could be the most difficult. Now, that's the one where you make a list of all persons you've harmed and you become willing to make amends to all of them. I mean, Kalua bit more than 250 people and one of them died. Yeah, maybe we can skip AA. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, there are some benefits to drinking alcohol. Moderate amounts can be good for your health. Immoderate amounts can give you a warm, fuzzy feeling of fraternity with the whole human race. But there are disadvantages, too, not the least of which is doing really stupid things when pulled over by the police. A 40-year-old man is facing multiple charges after New York State police say he tried to eat his DWI test results. Troopers say Kenneth DeZorm of Greenwich, Connecticut, was stopped for speeding at 5:30 a.m. After speaking with him, the troopers determined he was intoxicated and arrested him. DeZorm was transported to the state police barracks to be processed. Troopers say when his breathalyzer test results were printing, DeZorm grabbed the paperwork and tried to eat it. He is charged with driving while intoxicated, obstructing governmental administration, and criminal tampering. You know, I really hope all the cops present just stared at Kenneth unblinkingly while one of the cops, also staring at him unblinkingly, just hit the reprint button. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dr. Joanna Dodd Massey is a communications expert with a PhD in psychology and an MBA. She has done a deep dive into the five generations at work. The result is her book, Culture Shock, Surviving Five Generations in One Workplace. Dr. Massey joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Just tickety-boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us. So is this a unique situation, or have we in the past had situations where there are five generations at work, but we didn't make a big deal about it?
If we've had that before, which I'm sure we have, it was not at the level that we are experiencing today, because what's happening is people are living healthier, they're living longer, and so they're working longer. So we have more older adults continuing to work past the age of 65. So you're talking about baby boomers and the silent generation. And in fact, 29% of baby boomers over the age of 65, right, which is the traditional retirement age, were still at work or looking for work in 2018. That's a very large percentage. We've not seen anything like that before. And it causes a logjam for younger generations, including Gen X and millennials, and then at some point Gen Z, because they can't move up the chain, the corporate ladder, because the older workers aren't leaving.
Well, I am at the tail end of the baby boom, and I've often heard the baby boomers as being the pig in the python. And, you know, when you see a python swallow a pig, you see it gradually moving down the whole body as one giant clump. And they're not going anywhere in a hurry.
This is very true. That is an excellent image, and it perfectly conveys what's happening. I often call it a log jam, but yes, it is exactly that problem, which is what you're finding is you've got baby boomers and even silent generation executives who are either still in the C-suite, still running the companies. In politics, they're still in their positions of power. If you looked at the political race in the United States for president, not too long ago, before we got narrowed down to one Democratic candidate, we had three Democratic candidates plus the sitting president all over the age of 70. So clearly what's happening is that you've still got people in positions of power, in positions of influence, who aren't vacating, and it makes it very challenging for those who are Gen X and millennial to move up the corporate ladder.
I've often said that watching the political debates take place through the course of the general or the recent political season was like watching an open casting call for a remake of Cocoon.
So. Oh, gosh, I haven't thought of that movie in forever. It was such an excellent movie and a very good point.
Yeah. Now, what was there anything, any reason, any push comes to shove that you decided I need to write this book? And also, conversely, who did you feel you needed to write this book for?
Interestingly, because I have both the psychology degree and the communications background, I do look at everything in business through both of those lenses. And what I was seeing happening was in my own corporate experience, as well as for friends, family, colleagues, was an overall frustration with younger generations. It was mostly coming from my peers. So we're talking for me, Gen X, as well as baby boomer bosses. And I would hear them talk in a somewhat derogatory way towards these younger generations. And I looked at millennials and Gen Z and had a lot of gratitude and appreciation for the changes that they're bringing into the workforce. And I started to wonder what's happening here and why, which led me to writing the book, because it's not only important to explore it from a generational perspective, but I also thought it was important to explain to people what happens to us as human beings when we experience change, because we are biologically hardwired as human beings to resist change. And so what we were seeing was a lot of people putting up, you know, roadblocks and saying, hey, you know what, millennials, I know that as your parent, as your boomer parent, I raised you to have a work, you know, to believe in having work-life balance. And I'm totally cool with that if you're my kid. But as long as you're my employee, sorry, that doesn't work. Guess what? Too late.
Well, in doing your research, did you talk to any of the boomers about whether this is just a systematic situation that everyone goes through, in that they felt the same way probably when they were the young people in the office?
Yes, exactly. It's a really interesting thing happened with the generations. The boomers are a very large generation. The millennials are also a large generation. And Gen X, who were born between 1965 and 1980, so they're between the ages of 65 and 80. So at their height right now, they are 55 years old. They basically are a very tiny generation. And so the baby boomers were the hippies, right? This is a generation that set out to change the world. They certainly set out to change corporate America. And they, for the most part, did because of their tremendous size. Gen X is a relatively small generation, and they followed the boomers into the workforce and kept the peace and did as they were told and didn't make waves. So we haven't seen this kind of change in over a generation. Mm. Now, that is what I believe is causing a lot of the conflict. And it's not just conflict, by the way, it's misunderstandings. It is literally the way an 18-year-old communicates and thinks is very different than the way a 70 or 80-year-old communicates and thinks. So there's a lot of misunderstanding also happening. And I think that a lot of problems come down to translating
now,
between the generations.
When you say the way an 18-year-old thinks versus the way a 70-year-old thinks, are you saying that because of their different generations or just how an 18-year-old person, no matter what generation, thinks differently than a 70-year-old, no matter from what generation? You know what I mean?
I do understand what you're saying, and I believe that it's inseparable. I don't think that you can pull their generational experience out of their thought process. Certainly, a 70 or 80-year-old has a lot more life experience than an 18-year-old, but an 18-year-old has a very different perspective on what life is like today than the 70 or 80-year-old who might be more dug into their positions. And to give you an example of that, during COVID-19, when the United States went into this, you know, stay-at-home position, it was very interesting what companies started to see, which was the older generations who have experienced a lot of change. They've experienced maybe not a pandemic on this level, but they've certainly experienced, you know, hardship and difficulties in the world before, wars and all kinds of different things, especially recessions. It was more easy for them to adapt to what was happening, even though the technological part of it might have been challenging for them. But for the younger generations, especially anyone under 25 or 30, they could certainly adapt technologically to what was required, but they experienced a tremendous amount of anxiety and stress because this was brand new. It felt like the world was ending to them. They didn't have the life experience.
So you've written the book, you've asked the questions. Do you have the answers?
Yes. Well, interestingly, it depends on the question that's being asked. I don't want to assume that everything comes down to the generational lens. That's obviously not the case. There's a lot of factors that go into it. But the generational lens is one that we can look through that really helps give us insight into what's happening. And I have another book that I wrote, which is called Communicating During a Crisis, and it's about how to influence others. And it is along similar lines. It talks about change and, you know, our human reactions to change and why we resist it. But then it also talks about how to manage that change and how to help influence others. And the two books combined, quite frankly, truly hold the answer to the problem that we're facing. And ultimately, really, the shortcut is it comes down to listening, understanding, and then working with each other to enact the change, to embrace what the change that's coming and to work with it.
I guess the true test would be to focus study your book and have somebody from all five generations in and see if they agree on it.
That'd be excellent. I'd love to do that. Let's do that.
Again, I know I asked this earlier. Who did you specifically write the book for? What group were you trying to reach the most, if any?
Thank you for circling back to that. I apologize. I didn't answer that part of the question. I wrote it for everyone. It's for a very broad audience. This is a self-help book that is thinly disguised as a business book. And the way that I write is the same way that I speak. So the examples I use are pop culture. The way that I write is very conversational. This is not your typical business book. So I wrote it for a broad audience. And while I think that it will be very helpful and enlightening to older generations, I have also had people from younger generations who have either read the book or heard me speaking during various corporate talks and different public appearances that I do, who have come up to me afterwards and said, thank you so much for explaining my older boss and my mother, my father, my grandparents, whoever, to me. Like, now I get it. Thank you. Because the book does a deep dive into all five generations. It's not a focus on younger generations. It talks about all five of them and their character traits and their personalities and the eras in which they grew up in, so that we can all better understand each other and then move from there.
Fascinating topic indeed. I wish we could talk more about it, but we're out of time. The book is called Culture Shock: Surviving Five Generations in One Workplace. Dr. Joanna Dodd Massey, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Dr. Joanna Dodd Massey, author of Culture Shock: Surviving Five Generations in One Workplace. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0566, and you'll find links to Joanna's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about Muslim myth-busting. We'll also meet the editor of Agora Books. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. And lots more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. In a time when people seem to be going stir-crazy and need to get out just for the sake of getting out, some of the ideas that folks are coming up with are, well, a little pedestrian to say the least. For instance, for those missing travel abroad, Songshan Airport in Taipei, Taiwan is offering 90 people the opportunity to tour the airport and pretend to go abroad. On July 2nd, 4th, and 7th, participants can spend a half day going through immigration, boarding an airplane, and then getting off the plane and re-entering the country through immigration. According to the deputy director of the airport, people who didn't have the opportunity to take international flights can use this chance to experience and learn more about the boarding process and relevant services that are available. Yeah, tour customers will also get to take home exclusive mysterious gifts. Wow. For those who have never traveled, is learning about the boarding process and relevant services really something they could possibly be yearning for? And what the heck is exclusive mysterious gifts? If this is what some people in Taiwan consider to be fun, then they really need to get out more. Oh, wait a minute. This is an infinite loop problem, isn't it? Okay. Some folks never learn. On May the 9th, a New Hampshire State Police trooper pulled over 31-year-old Nicole George in Newington. Nicole was driving 90 miles an hour in a 50-mile-per-hour zone. After the traffic stop, she went on, but only 13 minutes later, a second trooper clocked her doing 111 miles per hour in a 65-mile-per-hour zone in Rochester. The first trooper responded to assist at the second traffic stop, and she was arrested for reckless operation. However, after her arrest, authorities found about 40 grams of fentanyl and some methamphetamine in Nicole's possession. They seized her Honda Pilot, and they suspect criminal activity was the reason for her big hurry. Well, no matter how you cut it, she's really into speed. The bells signify that it's time for the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
Two 26-year-old friends were hanging out and playing video games at a home in Palm Harbor, Florida, when one shot the other while showing him what he thought was an unloaded gun. According to Pinellas County deputies, Clearwater resident Sean Cook went to hang out at Shea Harkins' house in Palm Harbor. At around 7:45 p.m., deputies said Harkins went to retrieve a Colt M4 rifle that he had been customizing prior to Cook's arrival. Harkins reportedly told detectives he returned to his bedroom and pointed the rifle at Cook as a joke, which is when Cook responded, "What are you going to do, shoot me?" Deputies say Harkins admitted to pulling the trigger on what he thought was an unloaded weapon, Deputies said the gun had a bullet in the chamber and struck Cook in the chest. He was transported to hospital where he was pronounced dead at 8:55 p.m. Harkins has been charged with one count of manslaughter. Please remember Cook's famous last words. What are you gonna do? Shoot me? Because the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
And finally, in what could only be considered a Darwin file starter kit, Florida wildlife officials are searching for an alligator that bit a man directly in the face. Largo Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Scott Gore said that Travis Spitzer was in waist-deep water at Taylor Lake at around 5 a.m. looking for frisbees. Really? When the gator bit him in the face. He used his left hand to pry himself free and as a result had lacerations on his face and hand, said Gore. He was transported for medical care and is expected to recover. The incident comes as Florida is at the peak of alligator mating season, which often runs from May to July depending on temperatures. During this period, it is not uncommon to see gators roaming around and being more active, according to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Well, speaking of roaming and being more active, why is someone looking for frisbees in a lake at 5 a.m.? Well, perhaps it's part of his religion. Perhaps he's a frisbetarian. You know, they believe that when you die, your soul goes up on the roof and you can't get it down. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back on show number 0310, we spoke to Sam Mack about arranged marriages. Well, Sam, who is an American of Muslim descent and an experienced diversity and multicultural trainer and facilitator, has just released a new book called Muslim Mythbusting: What One-Fourth of the World Really Believes. She joins us via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Peter. Good to be here.
Glad to have you back on the program. You know, when you first started writing this book, I'm assuming you weren't aware or you couldn't have envisioned basically the storm that has been brewing over the last little while because of protests in the streets in the United States. And the reason why I bring that up is this a situation where a rising tide lifts all boats because of what's going on for the black population in the United States? People are also looking at how they look, think, and treat other groups of people?
I have not really seen that, but I do want to address a little bit of the racial tension. And it's not just in the United States. You see it in different parts of the world. As far as Islam and the book is concerned, there's a verse in there that says God has created us as different tribes and religions so that we can get to know each other. So our diversity is not to divide us, but it is an opportunity for education. And when you meet someone that's different than you, whether they look different or are from a different culture, you can actually learn something. And so that is the invitation and the reason that we were created the way we were.
So what was the impetus, or what was, or did push come to shove when you decided, I need to write this book?
Yeah, Peter, I have had so many friends come to me and say, someone said something about Islam or Muslims, and I knew it wasn't true, but I didn't know what to say. So I wanted a really easy, quick read book where people would know what to say and want to have some actual understanding, not just what the media is portraying. And the media, you know, it's for selling papers and it's for getting clicks and likes and attention. It's not necessarily for cohesive truth and bettering society. They've never said we're doing this to better society. It's a business.
When you started writing this, I mean, first of all, what are some of the biggest myths that people have out there?
Probably the biggest myth that people have about Muslims is that we do not believe in one God. So as far as Muslims and Christianity, we believe in the virgin birth of Jesus. We believe that in the second coming of Christ. So there's a lot of similarity there. And then the story of Moses and Pharaoh on the Jewish side is probably the most told story in the Quran. And furthermore, We do not believe that you have to be Muslim to go. We do believe in heaven and hell, but you don't have to be Muslim to achieve heaven. Anyone can go to heaven. Your deeds are weighed at the end of your life. Good deeds get you to heaven. Bad deeds get you to hell. So it doesn't matter who you are, what you do, where you're from. It's how you live your life.
In the Christian community, there are Protestants, there are Catholics, there are various sects that bring up Christianity. The same thing could be said for the Jews. Is it the same in Islam as well? Are there different groups, different sects, and they don't necessarily always agree?
There are some differences. I would say they're more political than religious. You might hear of Sunni and Shia Muslim. Shia is a very small minority. I would guess maybe under 10% of the Muslim population is Shia, predominantly focused in Iran. So there are Sunni and Shia, and we do disagree on stuff, but mostly it's political, on leadership more than on religion.
So what are some of the other myths that you uncover in your book?
You know, Islam is probably the most empowering religion for women. Women have a lot of rights in Islam. Right now, if I got divorced, I would do better under Sharia law of 600 AD than I would under current Virginia constitution.
Wow. Okay, yeah. So again, going with the myths that people have about Islam, why do you think it is that very fact that you just mentioned, why do you think it is that a large part of the population believes completely the opposite of that?
Well, part of it is no one's actually really been to that part of the world, so you just have to look at whatever you saw on a TV or read in a book and believe it. But people that live there, have a totally different lifestyle. For example, if you look at Sharia law, half of everything my husband makes is mine, right? And everything I make is mine. So I have no financial responsibility. When I was nursing my kids, I could, under Islamic Sharia, ask him to pay me fair market value for my breast milk because I was feeding his children. So there, and for some reason, just because I think maybe they dress different or they cover their faces, we get this perception that means oppressed, when really it's just different.
Now, I would assume, with the exception of some extremely orthodox groups in various religions, that like most religions, your day-to-day life within your faith isn't cut and dried, everything on the page. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, that is fair to say. And in one of the chapters in the book, I do give a day-to-day life of what my life is like as a Muslim. So how I weave my religion into whatever else I'm doing, because I feel it is important to shed light on what everyone is thinking about, like what is going on behind doors, what is really going on inside the house. So I just open that up and give a peek behind the curtain. This is what's going on.
And the reason why I ask that question is people who don't know about certain religions, and certainly about Muslims, seem to get the feeling that it's all lock, stock, or lockstep, and that everybody who follows that particular religion is in some way, shape, or form to a point of fanaticism.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the unfortunate misconceptions that's going on with the faith. There are gross stereotypes that are applied to all faiths, and Muslims, for some reason, have that. I think partly it's because of the differences in culture that we don't understand. For example, if you go to the Middle East and you walk in the Sahara, you will cover your face and you will cover your hair, because if you don't, you will have sand up your nose, you will be coughing out sand, you will be sneezing out sand, and you will be washing it out of your hair. So some of it is just practical to look that way and protect yourself from the sun, not necessarily totally religious.
Was there any this is something you do, as I mentioned, you're a multicultural trainer, you're a facilitator. Yet when there seems to be a third rail for some people when it comes to issues of religion, and certainly issues of religion that are, let's be honest, non-Christian to some people in some parts of the world. Was there any pushback when you came out with this book?
Yes, absolutely. There is pushback. But my goal as a facilitator, honestly, Peter, is to show people that we are responsible for our own actions and we are the ones that create diversity and inclusion or prejudice in the world. And it's so easy to sit and point fingers and say the government doesn't do it, the religious institutes aren't doing it, the media is at fault. But really, we're buying the message. And if we just control ourselves and not buy the diversive message, do our own research, open our own eyes, that's one more enlightened and aware person in the world. And that makes a huge difference.
And beyond the book, as I say, you're a multicultural trainer and facilitator. What do those entities mean to you? What is your daily life like when it comes to talking about these issues and spreading the word, basically?
Well, just like you're doing here, let's get a conversation started. Let's ask those tough questions. And so many times people do not ask a Muslim woman questions because they're afraid of offending somebody. And I wanted to be there where I could say, yes, you can ask me a question. And no, it's not a dumb question. And no, you won't be shamed for it.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because I have been on the receiving end of similar conversations just this week for issues I won't go into right now, but I have been on that situation myself, and I just find, just like there is in journalism, there really aren't dumb questions, just dumb answers.
Exactly. But, you know, if it's going around in someone's head, why do they dress that way or why do they pray five times a day or who really is Muhammad? Get, you know, talk to somebody as an individual, because as a group, we're all portrayed and it's easier to get prejudiced against a group. But talk to somebody as an individual, look into their eye, see the soul, look into the heart, and then make your own choice.
Excellent words indeed. The book is Muslim Myth Busting, What 1/4 of the World Really Believes. Sam, I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Sam Mack, author of Muslim Myth Busting, What 1/4 of the World Really Believes. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this show, which is show number 0566, and you'll find links to Sam's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's finger-licking good, if you're into that sort of thing.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the editor of Agora Books. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and more Stuff File news. Here on a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. You can also hear it on Spotify, and now you can hear it on iHeartRadio. Check it out. Okay, now on this show, I usually stay apolitical, and for the most part, I have kept my head down concerning the racial strife that has moved to the front burner of late. Also, regular listeners to the show know that on the Stuff File News, I usually add my own punchline at the end of any story. Well, today, I'm going to break both of my rules. I'm going to start the story with my punchline. And that punchline is, really? And you complain to me if I dare bring up an issue with Aunt Jemima or Uncle Ben? Now the story. A man in Scotland has been taken to court for using the term leprechaun to describe his ex-partner's new Irish boyfriend in a threatening email. 41-year-old Terry Myers from Aberdeen was fined for using the derogatory term in reference to his former girlfriend's partner, who was born in Dublin. Really? The message also saw Myers make various threats to assault the Irishman. The woman called police after receiving the email and taking offense to the use of the term leprechaun and threats of physical violence. According to the report, Myers accepted the charge of sending a message that was, quote, grossly offensive or of an incident obscene or menacing character in that it used offensive and derogatory language to refer to her new partner, unquote, and of also threatening his ex's new partner with assault. It almost makes assault sound like an afterthought in this story, huh? Yeah. The offense carried with it a racial and domestic aggravation. While his defense agent noted that Mr. Myers and the unnamed Irishman had some history, he acknowledges he should have not used the term leprechaun to describe him. Really? Oh, I've been called worse. Regularly. Anyway, Mr. Myers was fined a total of £280 for the offense. The incident echoes a court case from the U.S. back in 2008 when Irish-American woman Eleanor Vince took her neighbor to court after she called her a bleeping leprechaun. Really? Court. 18-year-old Annalisa Tucker was eventually cleared of all charges after her lawyer, Louise McCloskey, herself of Irish ancestry, successfully argued the prosecution was, quote, political correctness gone mad, unquote. Okay, back to Aunt Jemima. Don't get me wrong. I make pancakes several times a week. I truly do love what's inside that box. I just don't care for what's on it.
Aunt Jemima pancakes without her syrup is like the spring without the fall. There's only one thing worse in this universe. That's no Aunt Jemima's at all.
Yep, wishes do come true. They don't make songs like that anymore. They can't. And full disclosure, I never use the Aunt Jemima syrup. My West Indian roots dictates the use of molasses. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Chantal Amy Osman is the editor at Agora Books. Agora is a new imprint from Polis Books, one of the leading independent publishers of crime fiction. According to their press release, Agora titles are meant to explore society, economy, politics, and culture, race, and gender in unique and different ways, from a roster of diverse authors from varying backgrounds. I thought it might be interesting to have Chantal on to talk about Agora Books, and she joins us via Skype from Arizona. Hi, Chantal.
Hi, Peter.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us. Now, full disclosure, I decided to give you a call because, like so many publishers, I get emails about various books that publishers have, and you sent me an email talking about one of your titles, and I want to get to that at some point, but I thought your imprint was so interesting, especially in the times we live in, that I'd learn a little bit about Agora Books in the first place. So tell us about the imprint and how long it's been around.
Well, we launched, our first title was September of last year, Three Fifths by John Vircher, and we have had wonderful reception and success beyond what we imagined. Two of our three debut titles have been up for Edgar, Anthony, and Lefty Awards in the crime fiction community, which is wonderful. I'm so glad they're being read. But basically, Jason Pinter, who runs Polis Books, which started approximately 10 years ago, and I have known each other in the industry for many years, and we noticed that there was just a level of sameness to all of the crime fiction that was being put out by big five publishers, which is not a knock against them. I mean, it's good to read, but I was getting bored. He was getting bored. And we were noticing that crime fiction, which at its core is about justice and society and learning things about different cultures and people and viewpoints, it just wasn't being represented in any way. And we definitely weren't seeing what we wanted to read. So after talking for a while, we came up with Agora Books, which focuses on crime fiction of different social and cultural viewpoints. Now, and we make it that broad because it's just we want to read things that aren't on the shelves.
Why the name Agora Books?
Well, for two reasons. One is obviously Polis is of Greek origin, and so we wanted something that went hand in hand with that. But the Agora in ancient Greece was the center of culture. It was where people would go to, it was a marketplace where people would also go to discuss ideas and sell different things. And it was the sporting hub and the political hub and the cultural hub of a Greek city-state. So we wanted to represent all of that in the name.
When you started this late last year, could you ever imagine the firestorm that we have walked into that would probably, in a way, help bring your imprint into larger prominence?
No. And everything that has happened, well, I mean, we're in the midst of a pandemic. None of this is good. But at the same time, I am thrilled that oversight is too small of a word, a sin that has gone unchallenged for too long, not only in the world, but also in especially the crime fiction community, is finally having a spotlight put on it. So yes, our imprint is, you know, John's books are going, all of our lines books are selling and being talked about. But it's less about that and the fact that it's kind of like, finally, you know, this is something that is at the forefront instead of a footnote.
So from the time of inception with Agora Books to now, how difficult or easy has it been to find the authors that you represent?
Well, that's kind of twofold. One is, I don't know if you're familiar with Kelly Garrett. If you're not, you ought to be. She's an author. She's written a series. The first book was Hollywood Homicide. She works strongly with Sisters in Crime and crime writers of color, and she's also one of my dear friends. And we were when we were first talking about doing this, Jason and I talked to her and I said, you know, what were your experiences? And what if there's one thing I could do to make it easier? What could I do? And she said it was as hard for her to find an agent as it was for her to find a publisher, which is why Agora accepts and Polis also accepts unagented submissions. Because unfortunately, the mainstream is mainstream and they only look for what they can sell or thought they could sell, which I'm glad to find they were wrong about. But it's not been hard because those books are out there. And I love encouraging those voices. For our first line, John Vercher came through an unagented slush pile submission. Patricia Smith, I met at a Pitch Fest event. So she came in person and pitched me. And Tori Eldridge was from an agented submission. So they came from completely across the board. And it's been, I don't want to say an embarrassment of riches, but it's hard to only publish, you know, 6 to 10 books a season or a year because I get so many wonderful pitches and so many wonderful authors.
Mm. In a perfect world, you would have great success. So let's go on the assumption that you grow and you get bigger and bigger. Also, in a perfect world, what happens is the five big boys, as you mentioned earlier, will either come a poaching when it comes to your authors or creating imprints of their own because they see your success. Are you worried and or prepared for that?
I'm not worried. I hate to say I encourage it. We're small, you know, we're a very small publishing company and we can only afford X amount of advance. And, you know, we're lucky enough that we can give an advance and we do have distribution to bookstores, unlike a lot of other, you know, small presses. So we're good on that sense, but I encourage my authors to have success. And I know that, you know, hopefully, yes, someday we can grow and offer, you know, six-figure advances. That would be amazing. But some of these people deserve that, our authors, and just, you know, not just on Agora, but in Polis, you know, they're brilliant authors and you should be paid well. And we do what we can. And if somebody goes on to success, I mean, one of Polis's success stories is actually Rob Hart, who published, I think it was four or five book series with Polis, started out as an author there and recently got very large deals and a film deal with Ron Howard. And he's with, just completely escaped me what publisher he's with, but very large. And his next book is also with them. And so it's great. We wish him nothing more than great success because unfortunately that's just beyond what we could do for him. But thrilled to set the people on the path.
Well, give me the 1 minute elevator pitch. Who are some of the authors that you're most proud of in the short period of time that you've existed? That you have on your roster?
Well, that's obviously your first is always memorable, right? So John Vercher and 3/5, it was one of the ones that was nominated for an Edgar and also an Anthony Award. And John's book has, even above and beyond the critical acclaim that it's gotten, which I'm very proud of, the fact that I often get a text or an email from him that said, I just got a message from a fan who couldn't put the book down. And it really, you know, made them think or change their perception of something. And that is even more meaningful than any review or award, which, of course, I'm still proud of. So I'm very proud of all three of our debut authors. I've got... upcoming, the email that you saw from me is about Gary Phillips, who I think that you're going to have on a future episode. And I'm thrilled about this book because I love the old style pulp adventure novels. And this is a revisiting of that with Matthew Henson, who was the first black man to reach the North Pole. And he may have actually been the first man to reach the North Pole, but, you know, history changes things a little bit. So this is revisiting him in a Indiana Jones style adventure hero where he, you know, fights crime and solves mysteries and encounters a lot of historical figures along the way. So it's fun and it's informative and it's just, I think it's perfect for right now. Like it's, you learn and it's also escapism, which I think we all want. So I'm also very proud of that one.
Great. Well, and yes, we will have Gary on in a future show. It's amazing what you have managed to do in a short period of time. Congratulations. People can find out more information by going to the website, which is basically polisbooks.com, right? And you can find the Agora from there?
Yes, you can.
Excellent.
And thank you so much. I appreciate you, giving us this time.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours. Thanks for being on the show. That's Chantel Amy Osman, editor at Agora Books. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0566, and you'll find links to their site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. I've got one more Stuff File news story I want to share with you before we get to the climax of the show. A 20-year-old suspected burglar in Brandon, Manitoba, was caught when he returned to the scene of the crime to grab his keys. At around 3:50 a.m., a woman called police saying that her husband just caught a man who had broken into their garage. Once on scene, police arrested the suspect. Continued investigation determined that the suspect had broken into the garage earlier in the night, stealing two bicycles, a laptop computer, and a bar fridge. Police said the suspect hid some items nearby while returning others to his apartment. Once at his apartment, the suspect realized that he had lost his keys and he couldn't gain entry into his apartment complex. The suspect used a rock to smash the front glass door of the building, but still did not have the keys to get into his individual apartment. The suspect then returned to the garage that he had broken into earlier in search of his lost keys, where the homeowner apprehended him. According to police, the suspect was intoxicated. Now, if you're wondering why this moron hasn't been made the idiot of the day, it's because of the intoxication. Remember, idiots of the day are always stone cold sober, thus being in their complete, if not only limited, facilities. But that moment you've all been waiting for, it's here now. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
A Wisconsin couple has been charged after receiving methamphetamine through the United States Postal Service. According to the Wisconsin Department of Justice, on June 4th, the U.S. Postal Inspector reported to authorities a package containing 24 grams of methamphetamine had been received by the post office. Investigators say 25-year-old Benjamin Zarate and 38-year-old Christina Perez contacted the Wisconsin Dells Post Office multiple times asking about the package. After the couple went to the post office to pick up the package, police arrested them and they were booked into the Columbia County Jail. Zarate admitted to officials he is addicted to methamphetamine and arranged for a source in Arizona to send him the drugs. Zarate was charged with one count of attempted possession of methamphetamine and possession of THC. Perez was charged with one count of attempted possession of methamphetamine. Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. Meth, on the other hand, that's a deal breaker. So why would you think it would be a good idea that you could get meth delivered to you through the mail? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0566. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0566. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep environmental thought. If we don't do something about global warming soon, eventually there won't be any ice floes left to put our elders on.